Welcome, Marcel Velinga, and thank you very much for being here today with us. Bueno, reincidiendo en lo que ya comentábamos, en generar también una línea de trabajo, de debate en torno a la arquitectura vernacular, nos parecía también fundamental incorporar otras voces que no solo fueran, bueno, desde la arquitectura. Tuvimos la ocasión de escuchar al profesor Ferlenga hablarnos de esa visión de la arquitectura vernacular desde la historia de la arquitectura, más bien para nosotros, para los arquitectos. Y cómo, bueno, pues en nuestra propia historia de la arquitectura existen esos vacíos, esos olvidados, ¿no? Como llamaba Alberto Ferlenga ayer a estos arquitectos dedicados a reflexionar sobre la arquitectura vernacular en el proyecto contemporáneo, en el proyecto arquitectónico, como material de proyecto arquitectónico. Hoy Marcel Velinga, con su intervención Irritación terapéutica, Bernard Rudowski y lo vernacular, desde el mundo de la antropología de la arquitectura, nos intenta dibujar un marco más desconocido quizá para la mayoría que estamos aquí, en torno al campo de trabajo, desde la antropología, de los estudiosos de la arquitectura vernacular. Y como efectivamente la obra de Bernard Rudowski, tanto Arquitectura sin arquitecto como Constructores prodigiosos, marcó efectivamente un hito, una referencia. A partir de ahí surgió ese neologismo, arquitectura sin arquitecto, aunque desde el rigor, hoy no lo decía Andrea Bocco, él no tenía miedo a no ser disciplinar, a no encontrar esos límites, a no ser riguroso, pero Marcel Velinga nos ofrece ese panorama, digamos, más del mundo de los que se han dedicado a la historia, a la antropología de la arquitectura vernacular. Y cómo efectivamente hay unos espacios ambiguos, como él nos dice, unos espacios ambiguos en las publicaciones de Rudowski, y cómo él viene a formar parte de esa historiografía, de esa construcción la arquitectura vernacular. Bueno, comentábamos esa importancia de que estuviera Marcel Velinga hoy aquí. Él se dedica al mundo de la arquitectura, pero es doctor en antropología de la arquitectura, por tanto nos va a ofrecer esa visión que va a complementar muy bien en la que nos ofreció ayer el profesor Ferlenga. Él es investigador de la Escuela de Arquitectura de Oxford Brookes, en Oxford, y está centrado, como decíamos, en proyectos de arquitectura vernácula, de antropología de la arquitectura, también de regeneración rural y como no, de sostenibilidad y tradición, incluso en prácticas etnográficas de recolección. Bueno, yo destacaría como referencia para conocerle, bueno, que es coautor del libro de referencia del Atlas de Arquitectura Vernacular del Mundo, bueno, publicado en el 2007, y bueno, también destacaría el libro de Constituting Unity and Difference Vernacular Architecture in Minangkabau Village, del 2004, anterior al otro. Otra cuestión importante que también está muy presente en los conferenciantes, esa vocación de difundir y de facilitar ese contacto con la arquitectura vernácula. Marcel Velinga es director de la Biblioteca Paul Oliver de Arquitectura Vernácula, que se trata de una de las mayores archivos, de las mayores colecciones, tanto de dibujos, libros, revistas, postales, sellos, etcétera, que están especialmente dedicados a la arquitectura vernácula. Marcel, bienvenido. Tú ya me entiendes en español. I think that you already understand us, right, in Spanish. Welcome again and thank you.
Okay. Well, I want to start by thanking Mar Lauren and Yolanda Romero for this invitation and also for the introduction. I didn't actually understand what you were saying, but I'm sure it was all very kind, I hope. It's a great honor and a great pleasure to be here in Granada and at the conference. I was asked initially to reflect on Bernard Rudofsky's influence on the field of international vernacular architecture studies, which is really the field that I've been engaged with in the last 10 to 15 years. And I have to admit, I never really considered myself to be an expert on Bernard Rudofsky, and it's therefore quite a it's of great interest, really, to be here today and yesterday as well, and hear people that really are experts in the work and legacy of this man, and to kind of learn from them. And although I couldn't really understand, unfortunately, Alberto or Andreas' lectures yesterday, I understand from the images at least that I saw that Rudofsky thought about a lot more than just vernacular buildings. Okay, although Bernard Rudofsky is said to have professed that he had 18 different professions that he no longer pursued, including architect, designer, traveler, exhibition maker, writer, scientist, and cosmopolitan. In the field of architecture, he is best known as the author of Architecture Without Architects. The catalogue that accompanied the exhibition of the same name, first shown in the Museum of Modern Art in New York back in 1964. Although a rather small book, it is very widely known, quite possibly more so than any other book dealing with vernacular architecture. Nonetheless, despite its almost iconic status, relatively little was in fact known about its author until recently, while the book itself has from the moment it appeared been surrounded by an ambiguous mix of celebration and criticism. Hailed by some as a rich source of information and inspiration, it has been disregarded by others for its sentimentalist approach and its lack of contextual content. The somewhat enigmatic status of Rudofsky and the ambiguity of the book has continued up till today, certainly in the field of vernacular architecture studies, despite the excellent work on Rudofsky's work and legacy by Felicity Scott, Andrea Bocco, and the editors of the volume that appeared a few years ago, published by the Architekturzentrum in Vienna. In this paper, I aim to review Rudofsky's writings on vernacular architecture and will try to identify his lasting influence and contribution to the field of vernacular architecture studies. In doing so, I will argue that his work has more relevance today to our understanding of architecture in general than that to that of vernacular architecture per se. To anyone studying vernacular architecture, the name Bernard Rudofsky will be a well-known, if not an illustrious one. He's often mentioned in one breath with pioneer authors like Paul Oliver, Amos Rappaport, Henry Glessie. And his position in the field is ensured because of the iconic status of his Architecture Without Architects exhibition and book. At the same time, however, his status is also somewhat obscure and ambiguous. Unlike other well-known authors in the field, Rudofsky is really only known for being the author of one work, Architecture Without Architects. His other publications on architecture, including Behind the Picture Window, Streets for People, and The Prodigious Builders, are much less known and hardly ever quoted. This relative obscurity is particularly surprising, I think, in the case of The Prodigious Builders, which is a far more elaborate and detailed account of the issues dealt with in Architecture Without Architects. In part, it may be due to the fact that many of the traditions described by Rudofsky in both Architecture Without Architects and The Prodigious Builders are in fact not commonly identified as vernacular by those working in the field today. It is one of the paradoxes of Rudofsky's legacy, I think, that his interest, particularly in The Prodigious Builders, is often not so much in the common architecture of ordinary people, the type of architecture that is currently seen to make up the vernacular, but in historical traditions, sometimes quite elitist, monumental, and unique, where the lack of architects' involvement is inferred, if only because the names are not known to us today. The relative obscurity of Rudofsky and his entire oeuvre may also be due to the fact that he does not appear to have involved himself very much with the field of vernacular architecture studies that rapidly established itself during the 1960s and the 1970s. Certainly, the list of personal and professional contacts published by Andrea Bocco does not include any of the key names in the field during that period. Both architecture without architects and the prodigious builders constitute fascinating overviews of the diversity and ingenuity of the architectural traditions of the world, both in the past and in the present. Both are written in the same erudite, eloquent, witty, and polemic style that characterizes all of Rudowski's work, and include a wide range of examples to bring home a number of key points and arguments. Both are heavily illustrated with drawings and photographs, all complete with substantial captions, which help to reinforce the arguments put forward, and in the case of architecture without architects in particular, greatly helps to create and maintain interest in the work. The examples that are used are wide-ranging in terms of their historical and architectural scope, and clearly show how well-read and knowledgeable Rudowski was on the subject. They include well-known vernacular traditions like the cave and pit dwellings in Cappadocia and China, the Dogon dwellings in Mali, the nomadic black tents from the Sahara region, as well as more obscure examples like Anatolian beehives, Italian lemon tree enclosures, and Caucasian mountain villages. As I already mentioned, they also include many forms of architecture that are not commonly regarded as vernacular, like medieval castles and defensive towers, and prehistoric dwellings, tumuli, and monuments. As has been remarked on ever since the exhibition was opened, the geographic scope of both works is a lot more restricted than its thematic one, with most examples ranging from the Mediterranean and the Middle and Far East. As the subtitle to The Prodigious Builders makes clear, and I'll read it, notes towards a natural history of architecture with special regard to those species that are traditionally neglected or downright ignored. As this subtitle makes clear, one of Rudowski's main aims was to draw attention to architectural traditions that, at least until the early 1960s, were not commonly included in architectural history. In his characteristic rhetorical style, he asked the question, would we call botany a science if it dealt exclusively with lilies and roses? In terms of geography, he notes in the preface to Architecture Without Architects, architectural history is concerned with the buildings of only a small part of the world. And I quote, Europe, stretches of Egypt and Anatolia, or little more than was known in the second century AD. In terms of history, architectural historians tend to skip the first 50 centuries, he notes, as arbitrary a way of introducing the art of building, essay dating the birth of music with the advent of the symphony orchestra. Commonly, Rudowski notes, architecture history amounts to little more than a who is who of architects, an anthology of buildings of, by, and for the privileged, end quote. Rudowski's aim was to expand this restricted historical and geographical scope of architectural historiography, to break out of this, and I quote again, preoccupation with noble architecture and architectural nobility, by drawing attention to the many non-pedigreed architectural species found in other cultures, places, and times. A lot of these species, the houses of lesser people, as he calls them, are so little known, he notes, that we don't even have a name for it. For want of a generic label, we shall call it vernacular, anonymous, spontaneous, indigenous, rural, as the case may be. However, Rudowski's aim went beyond drawing attention to those other commonly neglected forms of architecture. He also wanted to, and I quote again, to break down our narrow concepts of the art of building. And he wanted to use the work as, quote, a point of departure for the exploration of our architectural prejudices. Rather than focusing on the work of individual architects, as architectural history so commonly tends to do, he wanted to put the accent on communal enterprise, on, I quote again, architecture before it became an expert's art. Architecture, that is, which is designed, produced, and maintained without architects, by ordinary, anonymous men and women as members of communities. In doing so, what he wanted to show the architectural community in particular were alternative forms of architecture that emerged from communities, places, and traditions, rather than from elitist, specialized, and increasingly commercialized professional structures. Despite their sometimes radically different nature, Rudowski argues, such forms of architecture, found in other cultures and other times, are as ingenious as those commonly represented in architectural history. What is more, they have important lessons to teach to contemporary architects about environmental design, the functional use of space and resources, aesthetic quality, and what he calls the humaneness of building. For Rudowski, they challenge the presumptions of the architectural elite about the supposed technological superiority of modern architecture. I quote again, many a feature invented in recent years is old hat in vernacular architecture. Now, Rudowski is commonly credited for having played an important part in instigating the increased academic interest in non-Western vernacular architecture that is noticeable from the 1960s onwards. Key publications like Bourdieu and Al-Sayyad's Dwelling, Settlements, and Traditions, Waterson's The Living House, Paul Oliver's Encyclopedia of Vernacular Architecture of the World, and the recent overview of vernacular architecture by Susan Preston Blair in the Handbook of Material Culture, all mention the influence that architecture without architects has had in terms of drawing attention to the existence of forms of architecture other than those commonly included in the architectural canon and historiography, as well as in embedding an appreciation of their functional and aesthetic qualities in architectural discourse. The combination of a carefully selected set of images, a provocative and at times entertaining narrative, and a first-class international art venue ensured that architectural traditions that had commonly received little acknowledgement and attention among architects were suddenly put into the limelight of architectural debate. Nevertheless, although the powerful influence of architecture without architects is undeniable in this respect, the extent to which Rudowski's call for an appreciation of the qualities of the vernacular architecture of the world was indeed new has already been successfully challenged. And I understand that Alberto's lecture yesterday was to a large extent about that. While the extent to which his work has influenced the further development of the field of international vernacular architecture studies is in fact quite difficult to ascertain. Although Rudowski is commonly mentioned in the standard works on international vernacular architecture, his work is not frequently discussed in any detail. And when it is, the discussions tend to be very critical. Although Rudowski himself claims that, and I quote, apart from a few regional studies and scattered notes, no literature exists on the subject, end quote, a significant body of writing on vernacular architecture did in fact already exist by the time architecture without architects appeared. The study of non-monumental, everyday, and often rural architectural traditions had firmly established itself in the Western world from the 19th century onwards, and had by the time of Rudowski's writing resulted in an impressive body of work that documented and analyzed the vernacular traditions of large parts of Europe and North America. While a lot of this work was carried out by scholars of Western folklore and architectural history, anthropologists had simultaneously begun to concern themselves with the study of non-Western indigenous forms of architecture, resulting by the mid-20th century in an anthropological discourse on the architecture of the world that was far more productive than is commonly believed. At the same time also, in the field of architecture itself, the study of vernacular architecture, and especially the vernacular traditions of the Mediterranean and Japan, had been actively pursued by both proponents and opponents of the modernist movement during the early decades of the 20th century. resulting in a large number of publications that discussed the qualities of the vernacular forms of architecture and used them to comment on contemporary design. And we saw a few examples yesterday in Alberto's talk. It is this latter discourse in particular that is very reminiscent of Rudowski's writings. Rather than being truly original, Rudowski's work was in fact part of an established modernist discourse that by the 1960s had been using the vernacular of the world as a means to reflect on contemporary architecture for at least half a century. Nevertheless, if architecture without architects is not entirely unique or original, Rudowski's work certainly seems to have been more effective than these earlier writings in raising the overall awareness among architects and the general public of the existence and qualities of vernacular architecture in other non-Western parts of the world. Up until the 1960s, a lot of the work had been scattered and rather hidden in academic publications, while an internationally comparative focus, as employed by Rudowski, had not been common. However, in the decades immediately following the publication of Architecture Without Architects, a significant number of publications appeared that focused on vernacular architecture from an international and comparative perspective, and that often used photographs to visually support the arguments that were being put forward. And some well-known examples of that include Paul Oliver's Shelter and Society and his Shelter series in general, Labelle Prusin's Architecture in Northern Ghana from 1969, Guidoni's Primitive Architecture from 1975, and Colin Julie's The Houses of Mankind from 1979. But there are more. The extent to which this marked growth of interest was actually related to Rudowski's work is difficult to ascertain. Oliver, for one, Paul Oliver, has written that he decided to publish his Shelter and Society in response to Rudowski's Architecture Without Architects, dissatisfied as he was with the latter's aesthetic and formal approach and its emphasis on the buildings as art objects. Most of the other works published during this period, however, Labelle Prusin, Guidoni, etc., do not refer to Rudowski or mention his writings only in passing. If reference is made to Rudowski in later years, it is always to Architecture Without Architects and hardly ever to the Prodigious Builders or any of the other works that he wrote. Now, whatever Rudowski's actual academic influence on the field of vernacular architecture studies may have been during the latter part of the 20th century, the wide appeal of his work is undeniable. Until this day, Architecture Without Architects remains one of the most well-known books on vernacular architecture. And, to quote Del Upton, retains, for some strange reason, its audience and its credibility, end quote. Back in 1985, it had already sold over 100,000 copies in the US alone, and it has remained in print until today. Although the fact that it is only about 7 pages of text may have something to do with this, surely the contents must play their part. Now, as Felicity Scott has observed, from the moment Architecture Without Architects was published, it was commonly positioned by reviewers, and I quote, as a nostalgic retrieval of pre-industrial forms, a romance with the exotic, the Mediterranean in particular, end quote. Tellingly, Rainer Benham entitled his review of the exhibition, Nobly Savage, Non-Architects. While 10 years later, when the exhibition finally arrived in London, Paul Overy wrote about a touch of Mediterranean sentimentality. It was not only Rudowski's brazen insistence on the environmental and formal superiority of vernacular forms of architecture that worried the critics, however. In academic circles, other issues raised equal concerns. Both the exhibition and the book essentially presented a pictorial overview of the exterior forms of buildings, resulting in what Thomas Hupka has called surface investigation. Strong on exotic images, and weak on critical analysis of building and design method. Paul Oliver criticized the essentially functional and aesthetic emphasis of the work and drew special attention to Radowski's lack of attention for the cultural backgrounds of the builders and inhabitants. Backgrounds that are of fundamental importance, he noted, to understanding the design, use, and meaning of the architectural traditions concerned. He questioned the unwieldy phrase architecture without architects and dubbed Radowski's approach moralistic, Puritan, and patronizing. Over the years, Paul Oliver's concerns have been repeatedly echoed by others, including Del Upton, Derek Hylands, Thomas Hupka, etc. Now, in The Prodigious Builders in particular, Radowski's intention is to write a, what he calls, natural history of architecture. His concern is to emphasize the existence and quality of buildings other than those privileged enough to end up in conventional architectural encyclopedias and dictionaries. In doing so, he frequently uses naturalist metaphors, regularly referring to architectural species, dinosaurs, and fossils. At the same time, however, he also wants to point out how much of this global natural history is under threat from modern commercial development and progress. A clear adherent of the so-called culturally despondency theory that states that the advance of modernity will inevitably lead to the demise of traditional cultural diversity, Radowski writes about the dangers posed by modern, and I quote, real estate, renting, and travel agents who cast a greedy eye on the quaint little houses for the first time in history, endangering the species. Elsewhere, he writes about the vanishing vernacular, progress's kiss of death, and the dead branches on the tree of architecture. Radowski's understanding of the relationship between architecture and culture, therefore, is both functionalist and social evolutionist. He emphasizes how different cultures and times produce different forms of architecture, rooted in place, community, and tradition, while maintaining that many of these architectural forms are destined to disappear under the inevitable advance of modernization. This approach is, of course, largely shared by many other scholars working in the field of vernacular architecture studies, including Paul Oliver. Unlike the latter, however, Radowski makes no attempt to understand the cultural and social context and focuses only on the formal qualities of the buildings themselves. Now, as cultural theory has developed over the last 50 years, Radowski's approach has gone more and more out of date. Debates around notions of tradition, place, and deterritorialization have shown that cultures have never been as bounded, homogeneous, and fixed to place as often assumed. While the large body of work on modernization and globalization has shown that both processes do not necessarily lead to cultural decline or loss. Cultural traditions, including vernacular architecture, continuously adapt, combine, borrow, transform, and diffuse, and have undoubtedly done so throughout history. At the same time, the increased emphasis in cultural theory on the importance of human practice and agency has made Radowski's neglect of the importance and role of people in the design, construction, use, and occupation of vernacular architecture more and more apparent. Despite stating, and I quote, that it always pays to learn the basic facts about the inhabitant, end quote, Radowski does not pay much attention to the way in which the owners, builders, and inhabitants use and give meaning to the architectural forms concerned. More than that, he essentially denies their existence as active and conscious human agents in the production and consumption of their buildings. In Radowski's writings, the designers and builders are anonymous or absent, while their architectural traditions are passed on spontaneously, unconsciously, and without much change from generation to generation. Ultimately, therefore, I think we can argue that Radowski's approach is an essentialist and primitivist one. Vernacular architecture, as an undifferentiated category that embraces anything not built by architects, is positioned in diametric opposition to equally undifferentiated modern or contemporary forms of architecture. And not just that, it is also represented as a superior form of architecture, one that is more humane, more honest, more refined, more beautiful and ingenious than the, and I quote, architectural blight in industrial countries. As in other primitivist discourse, for example that on so-called primitive art, Rudowski's portrayal of the vernacular is one of anonymity, timelessness, communality, homogeneity, limited change, and the dictating role of tradition. The vernacular is used by Bernard Rudowski to criticize contemporary capital A architectural practice, just as others may arguably at times use it to help define and legitimate the latter. Rudowski is a romanticist and idealist approach that, as I already noted, does not stand on its own, but is part of a long tradition in architectural discourse that can be traced back through Le Corbusier and the early modernists to Alberti and all the way back to Vitruvius. It can still be found in recent publications on vernacular architecture like Steen and Steen's Built by Hand and a growing body of writings on vernacular architecture and sustainability, which has emerged in the last 10 years or so. In this approach, there cannot be a place for individual, self-conscious and active builders and inhabitants or their cultural activities, beliefs and traditions, because their existence would undermine the basic ideational foundations of the approach. Now, in Bernard Rudowski, A Humane Designer, Andrea Bocco notes that Rudowski appears to have thought of himself as an unteacher. And I quote Andrea, a person who deliberately dismantles received ideas and preconceptions so as to make possible comparisons with disciplines, cultures, and places not included in the scholastic curriculum, end quote. Andrea quotes Rudowski, who once said that, I purge the students of prejudices and preconceived ideas, and I believe that vernacular architecture is a particularly suitable vehicle for what I call unteaching. Andrea argues that the main objective of all Rudowski's work was to bring about changes in perceptions, habits, and ways of doing things, especially those imposed by the closed and rigid systems of knowledge transmission of professional and academic institutions. Perceiving schools as generally tending, and I quote, to reward conformism, to challenge autonomy and intellectual curiosity, end quote, Rudowski pursued a non-dogmatic way of teaching that stimulates curiosity, the development of individual identity, and independence of judgment. And I quote Andrea here, Rudowski was always repeating that he displayed exotic extravagances, learned and archaic examples, a world of unusual forms and practices in order to stimulate, through difference, the critical sense, the imagination, the individual's desire to look into things more deeply, end quote. Instead of homogeneity, convention, and institutional structure, Rudowski, a professional in dissenting, quote, valued diversity and nonconformity and believed that students learn best through the confrontation with cultural diversity. Now, in order to achieve these changes in preconceived perceptions and ways of doing things, Rudowski employed a technique of disorientation. In the tradition of Montesquieu's Persian Letters, Rudowski used the cultural practices of other places and periods as a critical mirror to help illuminate the specificity and peculiarities of the ways of doing things in the here and now in our own culture. Everywhere he goes, writes Andrea, he cites other places as examples and takes elements of comparison from other contexts so as to cast doubt on the validity of local practices and beliefs. In doing so, Rudowski's choice of examples is commonly exotic and remote, or at least remote from the point of view of the audience that he addresses, and it's almost always arbitrary and random. as a result, as has been noted by many times by many reviewers, his work is full of contradictions. Andrea cites various examples where he praises one specific quality in one country, for instance, the decimal metric system in the US, and supports its opposite in another, the Anglo-American system of measurement in Europe, for instance. What is more, his approach commonly lacks the academic rigor that one would expect, as the criticisms of Paul Oliver and all the others, Del Upton, etc., have repeatedly made clear. There is normally no attempt made to understand the cultural context. Descriptions are frequently based on limited or unidentified sources, and the use of references is very limited. To Rudofsky, however, those contradictions and shortcomings appear unproblematic. And I quote Andrea once more, "Rudofsky's efforts are intended above all to offer his public a broad and lively repertory of arguments and illustrations that will capture the attention and convince. It doesn't matter to him that he takes heterogeneous elements and connects them in a spurious way that the scholar would not always find acceptable. He is interested first and foremost in effectiveness, including emotional and sensorial impact," end quote. In the case of Rudofsky's work on architecture, such impact is effectively achieved by the use of comparisons between designed contemporary architecture and the vernacular forms of other times and places. In both Architecture Without Architects and The Prodigious Builders, Rudofsky uses vernacular examples to show that technologies and practices that are commonly believed to be modern have been used before in other historical periods, or have indigenous counterparts in other parts of the world. He often discusses a specific vernacular tradition in direct comparison to what happens in our time or in the Western world, as in the case of water wheels in Syria, pile dwellings in Yunnan in China, pigeon towers in Isfahan in Iran, or the cave dwellings in Spain. In all these instances, Rudofsky emphasizes the ingenuity and quality of the vernacular traditions by directly comparing them to Western modern counterparts. And he tries to show how the vernacular works of architecture have qualities that, although not commonly recognized, are worthy of attention and appreciation. Indeed, he aims to show that many of the traditions he describes are in fact superior to contemporary ones, and he sometimes uses them to explicitly criticize modern assumptions, convictions, or prejudices. In reference to the Syrian water wheels, for instance, which is shown on the slide, he notes that, quote, "some of the contraptions of primitive technology may earn the contempt of today's engineers, yet their charm cannot be matched by modern machines," end quote. And similarly, discussing the Neolithic dwellings in Germany, he writes in his rather typical hyperbolic style that, quote, "in matters of aesthetics, the Lindenthalers were a good deal more imaginative than most mankind that succeeded them," end quote. In all this, it appears that Rudofsky's main objective is not so much to increase his audience's knowledge and understanding of the vernacular forms, technologies, or practices concerned, but rather to expose and challenge the assumptions, prejudices, and pretensions of not only his audience, but of the architectural community more generally. In his writing and lectures, he frequently refers to the supposed ignorance and arrogance of architects, sometimes in rather harsh terms. Thus, he refers to the field of architecture as, and I quote, "that progressive, aggressive profession whose unattractive products are uppermost in our minds, if only for their inherent uppishness," end quote. And he comments on, quote, "the medals and prizes which our arbiters of taste periodically bestow on presumably imaginative architects," end quote. And how, quote again, "part of our troubles result from the tendency to ascribe to architects exceptional insights into problems of living, when in truth, most of them are concerned with problems of business and prestige," end quote. For Rudofsky, it seems, vernacular architecture as a therapeutic irritant, and this is again a quote, For Rudowski, it seemed vernacular architecture is mainly of interest as an effective means to capture the attention of an audience and to address and to suggest solutions to issues that he sees are more important and fundamental than the knowledge and understanding of the architecture itself. In so doing, as discussed above, the vernacular architecture of the world is reduced to an undifferentiated category, represented in a dichotomist, essentialist, and primitivist way that lacks any recognition or appreciation of human agency or cultural context. To Rudowski, however, this reduction is not a problem, nor is he ever apologetic about it. As long as his work provokes reflection and stimulates discussion in the architectural community and beyond. And that, I think, it certainly has, as we're still talking about it 50 years on. And Rudowski's influence and contribution to the field of vernacular architecture studies, I would say, is as ambiguous as the man and his work himself, as the man himself and his work. In terms of advancing our knowledge and understanding of vernacular forms of architecture and of influencing debates within the field of vernacular architecture studies, I think it is arguably rather limited. Although Rudowski was no doubt extremely knowledgeable and included an impressive array of cultures and buildings type in his work, a lot of them would not be considered vernacular architecture today, while the manner in which he documented and discussed them was ultimately rather superficial. Together with the lack of acknowledgement of cultural context and human agency that is so characteristic of his work, this superficiality has resulted in an essentialist and primitivist approach that, as cultural and architectural theory developed over the last 50 years, will most likely find fewer followers in the view of vernacular architecture studies today. Although a similarly essentialist attitude is still, in fact, prevalent in much of the writing on sustainability and vernacular architecture. And again, I stress that this is a discourse that's standing quite on its own, really, and has only emerged in the last 10 years or so, writings on the lessons that can be learned from vernacular architecture for sustainable development. Although a similarly essentialist attitude is still present in that particular discourse, continuing work in the field of vernacular architecture around notions of tradition and place and culture, the impacts of processes of globalization and deterritorialization on the vernacular traditions of the world, have in the main resulted in much more thorough, contextualized, dynamic, and nuanced approaches that do emphatically pay attention to human agency and cultural context, and that try not to essentialize traditions by emphasizing their inevitable demise in the face of modern development, or by establishing simplistic dichotomies between the vernacular and other forms of architecture. Having said that, in terms of drawing attention to forms of architecture that are commonly not included in the architectural canon and that continue, to be honest, to fall outside of architectural historiography, and also in terms of provoking debate and stimulating discussion, Rudowski's work has been very influential indeed, and continues to be so, particularly outside the field of vernacular architecture, in the realm of architecture more generally. And as Andrea and Felicity's work has shown, Rudowski's main objective was to capture the attention and convince, to irritate and to provoke. And in this respect, his work has certainly been effective, even though it's not clear to what extent this objective was ever obvious to other scholars working in the field of the vernacular architecture studies, who until today continue to criticize his work and to be surprised, if not irritated, by its general appeal and popularity. It is the ability of Rudowski's work to bring architectural traditions that are commonly underrepresented in architectural discourse to the attention of a wider audience and to stimulate discussion and debate in the architectural community about the prejudices underlying their neglected status, that is probably its most enduring legacy. And in a time of intense internationalization and multiculturalism, challenging the assumptions and cultural peculiarities of the profession by reminding it of alternative ways of doing things remains as relevant as it was 50 years ago, even, I think, if it is done in an essentialist and somewhat irritating way. Thank you.